Blog Talk Radio.
Well, your dadgum government, you sorry so-and-sos. You got your damn hands in every pocket of my clothes. Well, your dadgum, dadgum, dadgum government. Uh-huh. Oh, don't you know? Oh, don't you love them sometimes? Uh-huh. Well, your dadgum government, you better pay attention. You're setting up there like a fool's convention. Will you dadgum, dadgum, dadgum government? Uh-huh. Oh, don't you know? Oh, don't you love me sometimes? Uh-huh.
Welcome to Handling the Truth. This is Terry Dodd. I'm here tonight with my co-host Mike Gaddy. Mike should be joining us in just a moment. And to get things going, I'm going to open this show with a prayer. Almighty Father in heaven, we're just thankful for all the ways that you bless us. We look at your prophecy and we see that we should expect exactly what we're facing today. And we just ask you to protect us through this this chaos that's going on. Father, we ask you to your spirit to be with us this night. We know that your word says that when we ask for your spirit to be with us, you will provide it in spades, more than a father would provide for their child. And we need your protection. We need your wisdom. We need your word. We need your truth. And we especially need your protection during this time. So we ask you to be with us this night. Help us to get through this show and do things that are in accordance with your desire. We pray that our listeners would have open hearts and minds tonight, and that we would bring a message to them that would be that they would recognize its importance. And we're just thankful so much for your son and the opportunity we have to have an audience with you. And we thank you for listening to us. It's in the name of your son, our Savior, Yahshua HaMashiach, we pray. Amen. Well, hello, Mike Gaddy.
Hello, Terry.
Apologize for not getting the studio up right on the dot there. It was funny. I got back here just a little bit, about 5:30 or so Mountain Time, and got so distracted I just didn't realize what time it was. So, but we're good to go now. And
all righty.
You mentioned about these two men that you were apparently saw what they kind of predicted, and how they saw the fog of patriotism and war, and over 100 years apart, and you apparently saw some similarities between those two guys. You want to start us out by talking about that?
All right. Well, the first thing, Terry, that I think that would like to mention to everyone is that I have seen and been involved in what are called PSYOPs, and I was wondering how exactly that a few politicians could get 300 million people to blindly follow what common sense would tell them was a lie. And, of course, I'm talking about all this crap on the COVID-19 thing. So, but you wonder, how do you go along with that? And so I was looking at several different avenues on that in the past week. And so then it struck me a couple of quotes, and from two gentlemen, as you alluded to, and I use that term loosely again, that at least for one of them, that were 100 years apart, basically. And the first quote I'm going to read is from James Madison. And I'm going to do it rather slowly because I want this to sink in with people. And Madison said, and I quote, "Of all the evils to public liberty, war is perhaps the most to be dreaded because it comprises and develops every other." So war develops all of the other evils in society. Has been at war now for 19 years consecutive, which and you know, when I was a kid, that would have been almost impossible for anyone to believe. And then when I look at it in other framework, I see that, you know, to the majority of my adult life, this country's been at war with somebody. And since, and during my adult life, none of them have been constitutional. Now, you can do all of the fancy footwork and call it, okay, well, the Congress can, you know, grant the president this or that. No, they can't, not according to the Constitution. So, but anyway, people use that to justify it. And, you know, like all other politicians, they justify what they want to. But then let's move on with Madison's quote. And he says, "War is the patent, is the parent of armies. From these proceed debts and taxes. And armies and debts and taxes are the known instruments for bringing the many under the dominion of the few." Is that not what we have today? "In war, too, the discretionary powers of the executive is extended. Its influence in dealing out offices, honors, and emoluments is multiplied. And all," this is very critical right here, "and all the means of seducing the minds are added to those of subduing the force of the people. No nation could preserve its freedom in the midst of continual warfare." Unquote. So there, I think we're going to see unequivocally that Madison nailed it. Absolutely, as we look at how you influence the minds of the people. And it doesn't make any difference how many times the American public is lied to. They accept the next program, or the next war, as gospel, because the emotions are inflamed. And the people believe that this has happened or that has happened. And then, you know, 25, 30 years later, that's proven a lie, but they don't care. They just pick up the next one. So you get people into a habit of doing this, Terry, and that's why the majority of society right now is walking around with a mask on. It doesn't make any difference how much evidence you show to them that it's not working. It doesn't matter. You can prove to them it's a lie. It doesn't matter. They are zombies because they have been indoctrinated into this system. And war has done, as Madison mentioned, has done an awful lot to contribute to that. The next person I want to look at is Randolph Bourne. And Randolph Bourne wrote in 1918, I'll get it right in a day or two. He wrote a program called War is the Health of the State. And he did not finish it because he passed away before he finished it. But there is some excellent material in there, especially if we combine that with what Madison said and look at the two. You know, again, they're a century apart, but they're both right on point. And Bourne said, "War is the health of the state. It automatically sets in motion throughout society those irresistible forces for uniformity, for passionate cooperation with the government is coercing into obedience the minority groups and individuals which lack the larger herd sense." What he's saying is those of us who are individuals, those of us who look at individual rights and individual freedoms, we're harder to get into that herd sense. And we see that throughout the country today. If you wonder who's in the herd, you look, they're wearing a mask. And to continue with Bourne, he says, "The machinery of government sets and enforces the drastic penalties, The minorities are either intimidated into silence or brought slowly around by a subtle process of persuasion, which may seem to them to really converting them. So now I read this new program that they're coming out with, and it's beginning to start now, that those of us who have the courage, the intestinal fortitude to think for ourselves, that they're coming out now with this new program, which is going to label us sociopaths or psychopaths even. We don't care about other people, so we are the mentally ill, which takes me back to the founding era and to Benjamin Rush, and he said that the passion for liberty was a mental illness. So this is not new. We can go back 200 years with that, to Benjamin Rush. So we look at this. Continuing with Bourne, of course, the ideal of loyalty, perfect uniformity, will never be totally attained. The classes upon whom the amateur work of coercion falls are unwearied in their zeal, but often their agitation, instead of converting, merely serves to stiffen the resistance of others. And we're seeing some of that. Some people are beginning to go, no, I'm not doing this. But that is why they need the feeling now to where we are sociopaths or psychopaths. We only feel for ourselves. We're not after the common good. And the common good is something that, you know, is used. It was used as early as some of the early state constitutions, the mention of the common good. People, the common good is socialism. It's a pretty name, a pretty flower for socialism. So when they talk about doing things for the common good, that doesn't do anything for the people and doesn't help the people, but it is a phrase that is used to lure people into socialism because it is a mind thing. Well, I can just sacrifice myself for the group. And that's a mindset, and that's what they're after, and that's what they've gotten now. That's why people who aren't wearing their mask are being criticized by those who do, because you're unthinking and you're not looking out for the common good. That's why they've said things about the mask. You don't wear the mask for yourself. You wear it for other people. More and more and more mind control. And then again, let's look at Bourne and his other statement. He said other values, such artistic creation, knowledge, reason, beauty, the enhancement of life, are instantly and almost unanimously sacrificed, and the significant classes who have constituted themselves the amateur agents of the state. And that's exactly what we're dealing with. These people who are out there criticizing people for not wearing masks and everything else consider themselves agents of the government. And they're engaged not only in sacrificing the values for themselves, but in coercing all other persons into sacrificing them as well. This is a classic psyop. Moving on with Bourne. War, or at least modern war, waged by a democratic republic against a powerful enemy, seems to achieve for a nation almost all that the most inflamed political idealist could ever desire. Citizens are no longer indifferent to their government, but each cell of the human body politic is brimming with life and activity. We're at last on the way to full realization of that collective community, key phrase, in which each individual somehow contains the virtue of the entire or of the whole. In a nation at war, every citizen identifies himself with the whole and feels immensely strengthened in that identification. We're seeing the exact same thing today. The purpose and desire of the collective community live in each person who throws himself wholeheartedly into the cause of war. So now war has been substituted with this pandemic. So we've got the people doing the same thing, but they were conditioned through years and years and years and years of war. Most all of the wars were started on lies. So the people who are conforming to the COVID-19 deal right now, they don't care if it's a lie. It's government at its best, and it's time to break ranks and get behind government. and try to tell me that that's not what we're hearing today, Terry. I'd just love to hear your thoughts on this.
Oh, well. I listen to Bourne, and I really start getting angry because it's like watching the lies that are on the boob tube. You hear these things that sound like it's real, that if you didn't know better, you would think you were hearing some kind of truth. The words are so deceptive and so they're hidden. They're like, and the people who are so unthinking just buy into this, and it sounds so intellectual. I mean, there's no question that you would say that Bourne was an intellectual, a progressive intellectual. And, you know, a wordsmith, somebody who knows how to use words to deceive people. It's precisely what we're looking at. And it really, really gets under my skin. I'm sorry. I'm listening to this and my anger elevator is coming up listening to it, because I can see the deception and the deceit in every sentence. It almost clouds my judgment because when you look at this and to some respect, you need to grasp what this man is saying. Because it shows the complexity of how the enemy works and how deceptive they are, and you really can't battle this unless you grasp that.
And well, that was the purpose, I thought, of bringing it forth tonight, because I realize we're not talking to too many leftist liberals on our program. And here again, what I want to do with the rest of some of Bourne's work is now, instead of war, I'm going to insert pandemic. So when you hear pandemic, in Bourne's words, it was war. But listen to this and tell me this is not exactly what we're dealing with today. At a pandemic, the individual becomes almost identical with his society. He achieves a superb self-assurance, an intuition of the righteousness of all of his ideas and emotions, so that in the suppression of opponents or heretics, he is invincibly strong. He feels behind him all the power of the collective community. Socialism 101. The individual as social being in a pandemic seems to have achieved almost his apotheosis. Not for any religious impulse could the American nation have been expected to show such devotion in mass, such sacrifice and labor. Certainly not for any secular good, such as universal education or the subjugation of nature, would it have poured forth its treasure and its life, or would it have permitted such stern coercive measures to be taken against it, such as conscripting its money and its men. But for the sake of the pandemic, of offensive self-defense, undertaken to support a difficult cause to the slogan of democracy, it would reach the highest level ever known of a collective effort. What's happening? This is a collective that we're doing. Yes, it's absolute collectivism, which is the antithesis of individuality. And there are no collective rights listed anywhere in a constitution ever in this country. There are no collective rights. Every right is of an individual nature. And so we have been totally transformed into this collective society.
And have you observed how the collectivists in society tend to be cowards?
Oh, they always are. They have always been cowards, Terry, because it takes guts to stand up as an individual. It takes guts
to
look
at. They also have a tendency to to be rats, to be, you know, stool pigeons, to, you know, the people that will go behind your back to rat you out because they don't have the courage to do it to your face.
Well, Terry, I remember, you know, several times over the past 10, 15 years, these little TV monitor things that they had in Walmart and other places that you could walk by and they had little messages. See something, say something. See something, say something. They turned this country into a nation of cowardly rats. And that's a very good point, because most of the people will very quickly turn on someone else. If someone else has the courage that a coward doesn't have, the coward wants to drag that down. The coward never wants to emulate bravery. It wants to destroy bravery and bring all the brave down to their level. And continuing with Bourne here a little bit, for these secular goods, connected with the enhancement of life, the education of man, and the use of the intelligence to realize reason and beauty in the nation's communal living, are alien to our traditional ideal of the state, which means the government. The government is intimately connected with war, for it is the organization of the collective community when it acts as in a political manner. And to act in a political manner towards a rival group has meant throughout all of recorded history war. There is nothing invidious in the use of the term herd in connection with the government. It is merely an attempt to reduce closer to first principles the nature of this institution in the shadow of which we all live, move, and have our being. Ethnologists are generally agreed that human society made its first appearance as the human pack and not as a collection of individuals or of couples. The herd, in fact, is the original unit, and only as it was differentiated did personal individuality develop. All the most primitive surviving types of men are shown to live in a very complex but very rigid social organization where opportunity for individualism is scarcely given. These tribes remain strictly organized herds, and the difference between them and the modern government is one of degree of sophistication and variety of organization and not of kind. Psychologists recognize the gregarious impulse as one of the strongest primitive pulls which keeps together the herds of the different species of higher animals. Mankind is no exception. Our pugnacious evolutionary history has prevented the impulse from ever dying out. This gregarious impulse is the tendency to imitate, to conform, to coalesce together, and is most powerful when the herd believes itself threatened with attack. And that is exactly what they're convincing the herd, 300 million Americans, that's what they're convincing the herd, that they're under attack from the greatest of all things, an invisible enemy. It's classic, Terry. When I look at this, when I read this and doing my research, and you know, I go from one and I look at something and then it takes me to something else. And I thought of this yesterday, of the connection between what Madison said in two or three paragraphs. And then you take it to Bourne, who broke it down in very small chunks so that you could actually, but it is there. And they created this thing, and I mean, absolute genius. I can get you.
Well, you recognize that it's counterfeit.
Oh yes. Let me elaborate
on what I mean by that. I've always joked about particularly some mountain towns, because you can hardly ever get those people to agree on anything unless you try to ram something down your throat, and then they'll all come together to fight you. And that seems to be kind of a human nature, that people have different opinions and it's very difficult for them to agree. It's why you don't talk about politics and religions and certain circles that because they're gonna resist you until you try to ram something down their throat. Well, this is counterfeit because they turn that around. They use a Hegelian dialectic basically to convince people that it's not them trying to ram something down your throat. It's the people they want you to fight that's trying to ram something down. It's the Hitlers. It's whoever that they want you to go to war with. The Ayatollahs, you name it. They pull up a boogeyman for you to think that they're trying to force something on you so that everybody will come together and fight them. And that's how this collectively works. But that's a counterfeit because it's all based on lies. Does that make sense?
As I was beginning to say, how better to control a people than to have them fearing an enemy they can't see, taste, or smell? It's classic. You've got to give these people credit. They came up with one heck of a plan. And as usual, they intersperse a little taste here and there so they can say, see, I told you so. So in 2017, Fauci gives a description that Trump is going to be faced in 2020 with a pandemic. Oh, wow. Fauci a soothsayer? Was he talking to his friend, a psychic in California? Or was he laying the groundwork for the mind, for the psychological operation that, okay, my mind heard this one time before, so it has to be true? Which is one of the nuts and bolts of a good psyop. So, to me, this is just utterly classic. People are absolutely petrified of something, and how better to get people into a complete state of panic, herd panic, than to have them think that the boogeyman is after them in the form of this pandemic. Control. You've got them to shut down the economy. You've got people to quit working. You've got people standing 6 feet apart. You've got people muzzling themselves, which is actually harming their health and not helping it. So you've got people doing the exact opposite of what they should be doing, and it's all for an enemy that they can't see and they can't point to, and they sure as hell can't shoot at it. But it invokes mass fear in the herd.
I'm not sure what you want me to say to that. You're right on.
Well, I keep every day, Terry. It's absolutely. I look at people who one must think would be otherwise intelligent people. I mean, you see people. I saw a lady the other day at a restaurant, and it was all I could do to keep from laughing out loud. Lady gets out of her car in a parking lot at a restaurant, and she drove up alone wearing a mask. Now, I'm not sure who she was protecting herself from in the mask. And I would have liked to have seen how she managed this, but she gets out. She's walking towards the restaurant, and she has a mask on, and she is carrying a purse in one hand, and she is trying to smoke around the mask, trying to slip the cigarette around the corner of the mask so she can inhale. And she's by herself. Now, stop and think. Take us back a year or 6 months. If someone would have noticed someone doing that in a parking lot, they would have for sure believed that this person was mentally ill. But all you do is you get the government to jump up and down and scream, and all of their control media to start everything with COVID-19 and you have people doing absolutely insane acts. I mean, I saw today where, you know, Tom Seaver, pitcher for the New York Mets and Cincinnati Reds later, passed away. And they said he had dementia and something else and COVID-19. So they get to classify this as COVID-19. And he dropped out of broadcasting baseball in 2019 or early 2019, I believe it was, because of health reasons and just total dementia. So, but here we get to classify another, and they get to bring it and put it in front of the people. You put out a name that they know and say, well, even he wasn't immune from COVID-19. We don't talk about their other underlying health things. And Terry, are you familiar with that report that came out sometime earlier, maybe last week or this week, that basically came out and revealed the fact that the majority of these deaths that they were claiming were COVID-19 were actually due to some other disease or what have you, but the people just happened to have the COVID-19, which COVID is a could be a germ as simple as the common cold.
Well, I've seen several reports like that, so another one doesn't surprise me. Obviously, the tests are at least 80% false positive, if they give them a test at all. Because a lot of these have been assumed to be COVID simply because the hospitals or medical professionals are getting paid big money from the government to list them as COVID.
Well, you have to think, Terry, at least with, you know, from my perspective, if we look at this, how extensive was the planning for this? This had to
be it's several decades went into it.
And they are trotting out each step, another step, and this last one to take all of us who are pointing to the insanity of the entire thing. We are now the uncaring sociopaths of society.
What do you call it? A tu quoque? Tu quoque?
Yeah.
Which is Latin for you also? In other words, it's a form of projection. It's a form of transference and projection of accusing others. I mean, that's basically what the whole concept of conspiracy theory is as well, because it's projecting someone's ridiculous behavior on somebody else just because they're questioning the narrative.
Okay, if I may now, I would like to read, and I can tell people where they can find this. And this came out, let me see what day this came out. This came out on the 26th of August. And I would like to read some from this report. Collective narcissism and the dark triad. Those who protest against the official COVID-19 narrative are to be categorized as psychopaths. And here is, part of the article itself. It says, a diabolical process is underway, which consists in identifying all those who are opposed to the government's management of the coronavirus pandemic. According to ongoing psychological studies, these opponents are categorized as antisocial psychopaths. The unbroken objective is to shunt the emergence of an organized protest movement pertaining to social engineering and the decision taken worldwide at a political level to close down the national economies of more than 150 member states of the United Nations. Peer-reviewed psychological studies are currently being carried in several countries using sample surveys. accept the big lie, and you are tagged as a good person with empathy who understands the feelings of his fellow man, his or her fellow man. Protest against the official truth or the big lie, criticize government guidelines, express reservations regarding the closing down of the global economy, social distancing, and the wearing of the face mask, and you will be tagged, according to this new scientific opinion, as a callous and deceitful psychopath. A so-called peer-reviewed empirical report describes those who refuse to wear the face mask or abide by social distancing as having antisocial personality disorders. Those who do not adhere to measures to prevent the spread of COVID-19 are tagged and will be tagged as antisocial. The findings of the Brazilian study, now look, they did this somewhere else to begin this, involving a sample of 1,578 adults, was published in the journal Personality and Individual Differences under the title COVID-19 Pandemic Over Time. Do antisocial traits matter? Empathy versus antisocial traits. The statistical methodology of this study is straightforward. It is intended to serve as a model. It consists in categorizing a so-called sample of adults from all major regions of Brazil into two distinct groups. It examines the relationship between antisocial traits and compliance with COVID-19 containment measures. The sample consisted of 1,578 Brazilian adults aged 18 to 73 years and a questionnaire about compliance with containment measures. Latent profile analysis indicated a two-profile solution. The antisocial pattern profile, which presented higher scores in callousness, deceitfulness, hostility, impulsivity, irresponsibility, manipulativeness, and risk-taking, as well as lower scores in affective resonance. And the empathy pattern profile, which presented higher scores in affective resonance. The antisocial and empathy groups showed significant differences. And this is quite a detailed report. And so, Terry, if you want to post that someplace for the people, I'll send it to you. It's very interesting. And people, they did not go to Brazil and conduct a study if they weren't planning on using, they want to find out what the people will accept. And so they got a group of 1,600 people together and pushed this through to them. Had they done it in the United States, the word would have gotten out. Somebody would have leaked it. So this is, it's classic. You know, again, Terry, if this was not so very, very, very sad, it would be funny.
We'll probably reach more people if we post it on our Facebook pages.
Okay, well, I'm going to do that, and I've got a couple of folks wanting it right now, and so I'm going to put that together, and I'll put it on Facebook, and I'm sure they will too. So that
to
me
is
open.
If people want to sign in and sign, if people want to sign in and pick it up off of chat, chat is open, and I can post it there as well.
Okay, that will be great. And so I will get it to you post-haste, Terry. Hang on 1 second, and I'll get it on the way to you right now. Done. There it comes. So let me know if you got it.
I got it.
Okay. So I can't understand how logical people cannot look at this piecemeal. But again, the point of it is for the majority of my lifetime, Americans continually to accept lies by the government, and they react to those lies as if it was the truth. So you know what? We may have a country that is mentally ill. The majority of the population, and I'm pretty indicative right now, they're mentally ill because there is something wrong with anyone who in their rational mind believes what they know to be a lie. I don't see how anyone could be considered rational or, competent, mentally competent, if they continually accept what they know to be a lie and act on it as if it was the truth.
I find that the closer people live to an urban center, the more mentally ill they are.
Well, that was done years ago. I wish I could think of the study right now, but there was a guy, I remember reading about this study, where a guy did that with rats. And he had them in a large area, and then he continually started closing them in to where they were closer and closer and closer confined. And they got to the point to where they became violent. And it was a great study. I wish I could find that. I shouldn't have brought it up without being able to provide it to people. But it was a very interesting study about what they have. They started stealing each other's food. And the thing that was ironic was here were these rats that actually started into homosexual behavior the tighter they were compressed with each other.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it was that study. I'll see if I can find it, and I'll get it to you, Terry. It'd probably take me a day or more to find that thing. But anyway, so here is the last part of it's certainly not the total thing, but the last part of Born I wanted to read, and it says the gregarious impulse keeps its hold all the more virulently because when the group is in motion or is taking any positive action, this feeling of being with and supported by the collective herd very greatly feeds that will to power, the nourishment of which the individual organisms so constantly demands. You feel powerful with conforming, and you feel forlorn and helpless if you are not with the crowd. While even if you do not get any access of power by thinking and feeling, just as everybody else in your group does, you get at least the warm feeling of obedience, the soothing irresponsibility of protection. Unquote. Again, it's sad when we look at this. Completes me on Born. So, what avenue do you want to take this now, Terry?
Well, I'd really like to. I think that we can move on to the other topics that you wanted to discuss. I think we pretty well covered this one. I don't know what else we can share that's really going to enlighten people on this issue more than we've given them. Maybe they need to digest this a little bit. I know when you mentioned Randolph Bourne and I revisited, that piece that I put out to you where he basically, the one author that was quoting it mentioned that that particular article, what was that thing called, Transnational America that Bourne wrote. There was an author that wrote an article about Bourne's writing, and he basically said that that Bourne was a critic who refuted Trump's worldview in 1916. And I believe that part of that, the reason he referred to it that way was twofold. One, Trump stopping, the open immigration of Muslims and others who are contrary to American thinking. But also Trump has kept us so far out of war. I'm not sure that'll continue, but at least to date, he has effectively been reducing our military offshore. And I think that's worth visiting, but it's a very, very complex issue. And when I read it, it was obvious that that there was an awful lot to be discussed. You could almost take each paragraph and discuss and expose how the whole narrative is counterfeit. So where did you want to go with this now, Mike? I think we you were I looked back at the actual show heading, and I'm in studio, so I can't get back over to it.
Right.
What else did you want to bring up? I'm sorry.
Well, I would just like let's take the conversation where you would like to go. I didn't have anything in particular except this combination. I know what we mentioned. We talked about, and you and I had done this on a show previously, but we talked about the letter from George Washington to Alexander Hamilton, I believe it was 1794 or 1796, to where Washington asked Hamilton what was going on in the government. And I thought that was highly unusual, considering Washington was president and he was at Mount Vernon, and Hamilton was Secretary of the Treasury and he was in Philadelphia, I believe. I think the government had moved from New York to Philadelphia, and he was in Philadelphia at the time. And Washington was reacting to some questions that had been sent to him by Thomas Jefferson. Thing that always struck me about that was why would the President of the United States write a letter to his Secretary of Treasury to ask him what's going on in the government? And I'm sure there's probably someone will come up with a very simple answer to that. But I, for one, am still at the point that that was something I found very unusual. And I knew that at that time, because I had compared letters between Washington and Jefferson and Washington and Hamilton and Madison and Jefferson, looking at these letters, and there was a huge battle going on in the government between Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson.
Well, let me jump in and with an idea of answering that question and get your feedback on it a little bit, because obviously it was a young government. It hadn't had time to expand into tremendous bureaucracies the way it has today. It was a much simpler time period. And I don't believe Washington had been, you know, acting like Obama and creating, you know, 110, 118 new bureaucracies in his first term of office. Hamilton, on the other hand, knowing that bureaucracies is a great way to expand government and to strengthen it and to make it much more unapproachable, much more regulatory. And here he was with his finger on the purse strings of the nation or the Federation. And it was him that was creating a lot of debt. And it was people saying, wait a second, and asking these questions that I don't think Washington had any idea. I think it was moving much faster than he could even absorb. And he didn't have the information flow that we have today with email and et cetera. I think it surprised him probably that Hamilton had done some of the things he had done so quickly. And that's why he wrote this letter, because he was like, hey, I can't answer all these questions because you're over here doing stuff that I haven't authorized. I haven't even been a party to. What's going on here? Is that the way it strikes you?
Well, let me read the first two paragraphs of Washington's letter. And this was 1792. I apologize. I think it was in the, I said 94. It was 1792. And Washington says, and obviously this elucidates the matter a little bit, he says, on my way home, and since my arrival here, I have endeavored to learn from sensible and moderate men, known friends to our government, the sentiments which are entertained of public measures. These all agree that the country is prosperous and happy, but they seem to be alarmed at that system of policy and those interpretations of the Constitution which have taken place in Congress. Others, less friendly perhaps to the government and more disposed to arraign the conduct of its officers, among whom may be classed my neighbor and quondam friend, Colonel M., and he meant George Mason, go further and enumerate a variety of matters which, as well as I can recollect, may be adduced under the following heads. Okay, now here's what he listed to Hamilton that the people he had talked to were concerned about. And so let's look at the first one, which says that the public debt is greater than we can possibly pay before other causes of adding new debt to it will occur, and that this has been artificially created by adding together the whole amount of the debtor and creditor sides of the accounts instead of taking only their balances, which could have been paid off in a short time. That's his first complaint. Now, there's a lot of background to that, Terry, and it involves Richard Morris and others, Gouverneur Morris and other people, as far as how they were playing with this debt to enrich themselves and their Federalists. So that was a question that the people were asking. This is what they wanted to know from Washington. Why is this happening? And then his second point was that this accumulation of debt has taken forever out of our power those easy sources of revenue, which applied to the ordinary necessities and exigencies of government would have answered them habitually and covered us from habitual murmurings against taxes and tax gatherers receiving or extraordinary calls. For extraordinary occasions would animate the people to meet them. So he is complaining to Hamilton that the government is creating debts, which the people feel will only create more and more incursions into their lives to collect these taxes by various measures. I guess I hope I didn't mess that up too bad. But here's Washington asking Hamilton. Of course, I understand Hamilton is the Secretary of Treasury, so he's asking these questions. And then his third point, that the calls for money have been no greater than we must generally expect, except for the same or equivalent exigencies. Yet we are already obliged to strain the impost till it produces clamor and will produce evasion and war on our citizens to collect it, and even to resort to an excise law of odious character with the people, partial in its operation, unproductive unless enforced by arbitrary and vexatious means, and committing the authority of the government in parts where resistance is most probable and coercion least practicable. So he is saying that here we are straining the taxes that we have now to collect enough to pay all these debts that you're accumulating as a Secretary of Treasury. And we're straining with these, and all this is going to cause discord among the people. And five, his fifth point, he says, they say that by borrowing at 2/3 of the interest, we might have paid off the principal in 2/3 of the time, but that from this we are precluded by its being made irredeemable but in small portions and long terms. Now, here is the First Bank of the United States. And you have to remember that we take this and we move it to 1795, move it 3 years down the road under Hamilton, and we have a 70-some percent inflation rate during that time. So Hamilton's manipulation of the First Bank of the United States, which was patterned after the Bank of North America under Richard Morris, and which today would be the Federal Reserve, was causing more debt and more collection of taxes. Does that sound familiar?
It sure does.
And he says that this irredeemable quality was given it for the avowed purpose of inviting its transfer to foreign countries. Anyone want to talk about the intrigue of the Bank of England on this particular measure? 7, they predict that this transfer of the principal, when completed, will occasion an exportation of $3 million annually for the interest, a drain of coin of which, as there has been no example, no calculation can be made of its consequences. So here the people have already seen that it's going to take $3 million annually in gold or silver to be paid to these foreign holders of debt. So we've got the same thing going on, Terry, in 1792 that was going on today. The banks are loaning money, which is fiat money, and they're loaning it to the government, and the government has to pay it off in gold or silver coin. And
who
then
was
the
Washington's Secretary of State?
Thomas Jefferson. And Jefferson is the one that's raising all of the Hades about this thing. And 8th point, that this banishment of our coin will be completed by the creation of $10 million of paper money in the form of bank bills now issuing into circulation. The people are catching on to this in 1792. They're being given paper money, fiat money, which they have to pay the interest on the loans in gold and silver. And then 9th point, they think the 10 or 12% annual profit paid to the lenders of this paper medium are taken out of the pockets of the people who would have had without interest the coin it is banishing. There's some hellacious good points here, Terry. And they would all be relevant if we wanted to ask these same questions today. And the 10th point, that all of the capital employed in paper speculation is barren and useless, producing like that on a gaming table, no accession to itself, and is withdrawn from commerce and agriculture where it would have produced addition to the common mass. That it nourishes in our citizens vice and idleness instead of industry and morality. That it has furnished effectual means of corrupting such a portion of the legislature as turns the balance between the honest voters, which every way it is directed. And this came in a letter from Jefferson, Secretary of State, to the president, complaining that Hamilton was using money, the votes of members of the legislature. This is 1792, guys. It's under a brand new constitution and a brand new government.
Does it state what time of year it was in 1792?
July.
Because the Coinage Act was enacted in April.
Right. So here, the other point, I think that here is also what I wish I had the letter of Jefferson to Washington right now to compare these. I'm sorry, I should have had that. But here is what Washington says to Hamilton, that this corrupt squadron, talking about the paid, bought and paid for legislators, deciding the voice of the legislature, have manifested their dispositions to get rid of the limitations imposed by the Constitution on the general legislature, limitations on the faith of which the states acceded to that instrument. Hamilton is using money from the bank to buy politicians to pass the bills and the laws that he wants passed, and they're getting what he's basically saying. Washington is saying someone is paying off the legislators with this money, with this paper money, to get them to actually enact laws which are unconstitutional. Wow. Really? You mean that happens? That happened back then? It's still happening now? And then Washington says that the ultimate object of all of this is to prepare the way for a change from the present Republican form of government to that of a monarchy, of which the British Constitution is to be our model. Really? Isn't that exactly what Hamilton proposed on June the 18th of 1787 in Philadelphia? What Hamilton proposed that was rejected, he is now enacting as an officer in the administration. Here's the other key point by Washington. He said that this was contemplated in the convention, they say is no secret, because its partisans have made none of it to affect it then was impracticable. But they are still eager after their object and are predisposing everything for its ultimate attainment. So that is just, I mean, they're nailing it right here. Everything that happened in the convention, Washington is now complaining to Hamilton about. That it was contemplated in the convention, they say, is no secret. They all knew it. They knew on June the 18th, Hamilton said this was exactly what he wanted.
Are you of the opinion that Washington was not aware of everything that went on at that convention, even though he was present?
Well, you know, I read on Sunday on the program, and you were on there as well. I read what Forrest MacDonald, one of the professors of American history at the University of Alabama. I read what he said about Washington, and he probably had researched this better than anyone, and so I will read it again what he said about Washington. He said, Washington at 54 or at any other age could have added little to the intellectual average of any convention, and his knowledge of what to do in one barely extended beyond rules of order. But that was all he needed to know, for any assembly he attended was likely to elect him presiding officer. He had two attributes that, even without his unparalleled prestige, prompted men to choose him the leader. And it mattered not that one of the attributes was trivial, and the other he carried to the point of triviality. Nor did it matter that for the last third of his life he was largely and self-consciously playing a role. The first attribute was that he looked like a leader. In an age in which most Americans stood about 5'5" and measured nearly 3/4 of that around the waist, Washington stood 6 feet and had broad, powerful shoulders and slim hips. And he had learned the trick. When men said something beyond his ken, which meant beyond his understanding, spelled as K-E-N, of looking at them in a way that made them feel irreverent or even stupid. The other attribute was personal integrity. At times, Washington's integrity was bewildering, for his artlessness and his susceptibility to flattery led him to endorse actions that less scrupulous but more cagey men would shun. Times it could be overbearing, stifling, but it was unimpeachable, and everyone knew it, and that above all made Washington useful. Others would do the brain work and the dirty work. Washington need only to be there. But if there was to be a national government, he absolutely had to be there to lend his name to the proceedings. Unquote.
I remember some of that. I didn't remember all of it. So I'm glad you reread
that. Is it perhaps possible that Washington is not the person that we believe. You know, and Forrest McDonald says his character was unimpeachable. His integrity was unimpeachable. And that is, you know, that everything I've read about him says the same thing. But it doesn't say he was brilliant. And he obviously, if you look at what was happening with Hamilton, Hamilton was leading him around by the nose. And I thought it was very telling of Hamilton's answer, initial answer. Now, he eventually did answer Washington, and he wrote page after page after page after page of answer, which was classic lawyer-ese. You could read one of his answers, and when you finished reading it, you had no idea what he just said. Now, I'll be happy to send that answer that he sent. But his first answer to Washington was basically, and I'm really condensing it down, his answer to Washington was, I'm extremely busy right now. I'll get to it when I get a chance. And over a month later, he finally answered Washington. Step by step, but like I said, he wrote a book. And that was also what he did with Jefferson when Jefferson wrote about the First Bank of the United States being unconstitutional, and Jefferson put it in a very short, concise manner, and Hamilton answered him with about 13,000 words.
Have you come across anything from Washington as a response to Hamilton's reply?
I have not. But
that should have been an eye opener for Washington.
Washington had a blind spot when it came to Hamilton. Several historians have said that Washington looked upon Hamilton basically as the son he didn't have. And it was indulgent. He was indulgent toward Hamilton, and Forrest McDonald mentions that in the book, that he was indulgent toward Hamilton because Hamilton was constantly flattering Washington. And, of course, from what I read, Forrest McDonald says that Washington was most susceptible to flattery. And have you ever read about the first inauguration of when Washington was inaugurated, Terry?
I don't think so.
It started out.
But
it's
obvious that Hamilton was playing the sycophant.
Oh, yes. Hamilton was a genius. He was an evil genius, but he was a genius. And in some of my recent studies, I was doing some recent studies for my program on Sunday night about slavery. And I found out that during the colonial period, one of the people who fought hardest against slavery, more than almost any of the other people that we would call founders, was ironically Aaron Burr. And I'm also looking into Burr's conspiracy trial, which, Jefferson accused Burr of planning to split the United States. And they actually went to trial. I believe it was in 1806. And, of course, Luther Martin represented Aaron Burr. That's a classic part of history that people aren't taught about at all. Jefferson, I'd love to. Jefferson, in his pursuit of prosecuting Burr, actually got a little over the edge a little bit. And it is a classic part of history. I was almost angry when I got into that Burr conspiracy that I had never heard of any detail of this, that Burr was accused of moving after he had been vice president for the first 4 years in Jefferson administration, he moved out and started moving down the Mississippi River and talking to people, and was actually moving with the chief general of the army at that time. And all of a sudden, they were predicted of he was trying to split off part of the southern United States. So we were looking at secession very early on.
I can see why.
That was kind of amazing to me, researching on this slavery, to find out that probably no one fought harder against the institution of slavery during colonial America, or at least in the early part of America, than Aaron Burr, at least the founding era, as we call it. He and Luther Martin very much fought against, and Luther Martin spoke against slavery in the Constitutional Convention of 1787 very, very, very poetically. I mean, he just blasted it. And he and Burr ended up being very close friends, and Luther Martin had the hots for Aaron Burr's oldest daughter. And, of course, this was after his wife passed away. But, yeah, that Burr went to his defense against, and, did he give Jefferson the Dickens in that trial? That yeah, that would be a great subject for a program in the future, Terry.
Wow. A lot of soap operas involved here. I didn't know that about
the part.
Luther Martin.
Yeah, Luther Martin hated Thomas Jefferson. And there's lots of these things. And see, that's the thing I think that we really miss out, Terry, because I wasn't taught any of this in school. History was dry dates, dry numbers. We didn't look at the people as actually being human beings. We didn't look at their frailties. We didn't look at the, you know, all of the good things about good things we were told, but we weren't told that they were, you know, frail human beings just like we are. It was a classic to look at this, and that's why I've said I would like to see the founding era of America made into a movie. Of course, they wouldn't want to do that because you would might have to stick somewhat with the truth, and that would be really tough. But the, you know, the silly things like, you know, Gouverneur Morris and Alexander Hamilton was close friends, and at a function one time, Alexander Hamilton bet Gouverneur Morris several dinners that Morris wouldn't walk up and just put his hand on Washington's shoulder. So Morris made the effort, walked over, put his hand on Washington's shoulder, and Washington turned, and as Gouverneur Morris said, he turned him into an icicle with the stare he got. And Gouverneur Morris wrote later, he said, "I would have bought Hamilton a year's worth of dinners to have avoided that incident."
So the respect that Washington had was a good amount of fear from some people.
Well, and, you know, there was the plot, and I believe Hamilton and Gouverneur Morris were both involved in it. They went to the Army generals, all of the generals of the Revolutionary Army. They got together at Newburgh and supposedly came up with a conspiracy to take over the government. And allegedly, Gouverneur Morris and Alexander Hamilton were behind this. Washington found out about it, and he went to Newburgh and made a speech to the revolutionary generals and basically told them, "No, you ain't doing this. You're not going to revolt against the government. Not after we just won the war with England. You're not going to do this," because the all of the generals wanted to pay for life. And the Congress wasn't about to, under the Articles of Confederation, wasn't about to go along with them. So there was this Newburgh conspiracy, and allegedly Washington figured that Gouverneur Morris did have something to do with it, and he didn't speak to Gouverneur Morris for over a year because of that. So yeah, these are.
But you said Hamilton had something to do with that?
Well, Hamilton was involved in it too, but I don't think. Washington ever held him as accountable for that as he did Gouverneur Morris.
So what year was this?
That was, oh my goodness, it was under the Articles of Confederation. So it was probably, I'm going to just throw a guess out here. I don't remember exactly, because that's one of the things that happened to me. High school, all I did was learn dates. Now I hate dates, but I love the other parts of history. But if I'm not mistaken, it was like 1784, 1785, somewhere in there.
Before even Annapolis.
Right.
Another clue that it was a criminal conspiracy.
Oh, yes. There's no doubt. And, of course, you know, you had the meeting in 1785 at Mount Vernon, the Mount Vernon meeting, where it was probably set in motion then 2 years before. And, they planned the Annapolis Convention. And then, you know, Washington didn't show up. So at the Annapolis Convention, and they held the convention in Maryland, and Maryland wouldn't even send a delegation. Only 5 states out of 13 sent a delegation. Of course, they couldn't do anything. But the meeting at Annapolis, especially Hamilton and Gouverneur Morris and Robert Morris and several others were involved there. And they from there sprung the idea for to pitch the Constitutional Convention of 1787 with Madison in the lead. He was the chief conspirator, I believe.
Interesting. We've got about 3 minutes, Mike. How do you want to wrap this up?
Well, gosh, Jerry, we've covered so much territory here. I'm not exactly sure how I would go about that. And I may be in trouble here. My phone is about to run out of juice, my friend.
Oh, we can wrap this up right now if you like.
Yeah. Well, probably better. I'm sorry. Oh my goodness. Yeah.
I'll play a longer piece. Thank you, Mike. Appreciate your lessons. They're awesome. You always surprise me with something in the midst of it. And I'm just very thankful that you're my co-host here and that we can have this time to really learn about true history. So for all of you that listen tonight, thank you very much for being with us. And we will see you next Thursday night with Handling the Truth. Good night, everyone.
Please welcome Disturbed!
Darkness, my own friend, I've come to talk with you again, because a vision softly creeping left its scenes while I was sleeping, and the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence. In restless dreams I walked alone, narrow streets of cobblestone, neath the halo of a street lamp, I turned my collar to cold and damp, when my eyes were stared by the flash of a neon light that split the night and touched the sound of silence. And in the naked light I saw 10,000 people, maybe more. People talking without speaking. People hearing without listening. People writing the sound of silence. Will say now you do not know. Silence like a cancer grows. Hear my words.